Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 36th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, covering all of Chicago's major sports teams. Plus, later in the show, we'll talk with a special guest about Major League Baseball, as well as some Cubs and Sox news. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports. And hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the Chicagoland area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Downs Shopping Center, at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, Illinois. If you have any questions, give them a call at 708-247-2100. That's 708-247-2100. Well, some big news today to start off on, talking about the Chicago Bulls. The NBA draft is this Thursday, June 21st at 6 p.m., and the Bulls have the 7th overall pick. So the question is, who will the Bulls decide to draft? Now, before we get to that part, I'd like to take a look back at some of the Bulls' previous draft picks and show just how good, or bad rather, they've been in the past with making selections in the draft. Now, Kirk Heinrich back in 2003 was a very good choice considering. I mean, at the time, the Bulls were trying to get someone like Dwayne Wade or Carmelo Anthony or even LeBron James, but couldn't because they had the number 7 pick. And Heinrich himself had a very good career here in Chicago, a former team captain, and he led the team to multiple playoff appearances before the era of Derrick Rose. So not a bad pick there. And the year after at number 3, the Bulls chose Ben Gordon, another very good pick, formerly a leading scorer on the team, again, even during the Derrick Rose era. In Rose's rookie year, Ben Gordon was the highest scoring player on the team. Now, we go to 2006, and this is where things get a bit murky. The Bulls decided to choose Tyrus Thomas with the number 4 overall pick, and we all know how that worked out. Thomas was a complete bust here in Chicago. He got traded to the Bobcats and did okay, but nevertheless, guys chosen behind him include Brandon Roy, Rudy Gay, Rajon Rondo, and Kyle Lowry. All of those guys could have worked out much better for the Bulls, rather than Tyrus Thomas, so a tough move there by Chicago during that draft. We go to 2007, and the Bulls took Joakim Noah with the number 9 overall pick. Now, Noah is a bit of an anomaly because he didn't do that bad in a Bulls uniform. I mean, this guy was a former Defensive Player of the Year, so you can't sit there and say that he was necessarily a bust, but yet the players chosen after Noah were quite prominent. I mean, if it were up to me, I'd rather take Marc Gasol, who wasn't drafted until the beginning of the second round, instead of Joakim Noah at the number 9 spot. Gasol is still in the NBA today, he's a 2-time All-Star, and he has led the Grizzlies to multiple postseason appearances over the years. So again, if it were up to me, I'd rather take Marc Gasol over Joakim Noah, who right now is not doing very well, barely finding minutes with the New York Knicks. Then we go to 2008, and we all remember this year, the Bulls getting the number 1 pick and having to choose between Derrick Rose or Michael Beasley. Now, many will say today, many Bulls fans that is, that Derrick Rose was a bust, but I find that quite the contrary. Rose won an MVP and really defined an era here with the Chicago Bulls. I mean, you can look online, it's a historical era, the Derrick Rose era. He did great things here in Chicago before succumbing to injuries. So you can't sit here and say that Michael Beasley would have been a better choice than Derrick Rose. In the end, I like the pick that Gar Forman and John Paxson made, choosing Rose instead of Beasley. I mean, when you look at it, the Bulls have made some very good selections. Unfortunately, though, they've made more bad selections than good. Let's take a look at the 2012 draft. One where the Bulls had the 29th overall pick and selected Marcus Teague, the brother of current Timberwolves point guard Jeff Teague. Marcus Teague, however, did not do well in a Bulls uniform and is currently a D-League player, barely finding time in that league nevertheless. Who was picked behind Marcus Teague? Well, let's see. Jay Crowder, an all-star. Draymond Green, a superstar on the Golden State Warriors. And Chris Middleton, a guy who's really coming into his own right now on the Milwaukee Bucks. So a horrible decision there by the Bulls. And some of these other ones that we're going to talk about only get worse. We go to 2013. The Bulls had the number 20 overall pick in the draft and selected Tony Snell. Okay, that's fine, but who went after Snell? Gorgui Dieng, a player right now on the Timberwolves doing very well, Tim Hardaway Jr., and Rudy Gobert, a defensive player of the year and perennial NBA All-Star. Again, the Bulls passed on two very good players and instead selected Tony Snell, a guy who's not even on the team anymore. But when you talk about the Bulls and their draft woes, this one certainly comes to mind. The 2014 NBA Draft. The Bulls have pick number 11 and select Doug McDermott out of Creighton. After Doug McDermott, the pick immediately after, the Magic ended up selecting Dario Saric, who is now a superstar on the 76ers. And after Saric, Zach LaVine, who the Bulls recently got in a trade. But the point is, those were very good players chosen directly after Doug McDermott. And now, McDermott's nowhere. He's barely even finding time in the NBA with the Dallas Mavericks. And the best part about it was that when McDermott didn't perform, the Bulls traded him. But what they got back was horrendous. They traded him and Taj Gibson to the Thunder, getting back Joffrey LaVerne, Anthony Morrow, and Cameron Payne. LaVerne sucks. Morrow is too old, and Cameron Payne is a complete draft bust that the Thunder traded to get a quality player in Taj Gibson and someone who's at least league average in Doug McDermott. So again, the Bulls have had their troubles making transactions and making draft selections. That's why this year, especially being the first year of a rebuild, the Bulls have to really think about who they want to model their franchise around. As we had mentioned in podcasts before, Michael Porter Jr. is still the consensus pick for the Bulls right now. And personally, I have no problem with that. This guy was a stud in high school, and because of an injury last year, only played in a limited amount of games with Missouri. I feel like that now that he is fully recovered and ready to go, he'll be the same player that he was before and help out the Bulls in the NBA. I mean, this guy is 6'11", 210 pounds, so of course, he can rebound and he can score, but he can also shoot threes. This guy is a very athletic player, and someone the Bulls have been looking for a while. You put him and Lauri Markkanen as your power forward and center tandem, and you've got one of the best combos in the NBA at that position. Because remember, Markkanen was named to the All-NBA Rookie First Team, so he was one of the best rookies in the NBA this year, and only has room to improve. You pair him with Michael Porter Jr., and the result is very good and very promising for a Bulls team that's still trying to rebuild and become better in the future. Just a reminder, make sure to watch the NBA Draft live. I know I will be. Check it out on ESPN at 6 o'clock this coming Thursday. Let's see who the Bulls end up selecting. We now go to the Diamond and talk about some Chicago Cubs news. Right now, Yu Darvish is a big-time story as he is ready to throw a simulated game on the field, meaning that his return could be very soon. Darvish is scheduled to throw in a simulated game on Wednesday, and depending on how that goes, he will make a return to the Cubs' rotation. There is a bit of a problem, though, because with Darvish returning, the Cubs will find themselves in a bit of a pickle. See, during Darvish's absence, Mike Montgomery has been filling in the starting rotation, and he's done exceptionally well. In 22 games overall and 4 games started, he has an ERA of 3.31 and a 2-2 record. So now we beg the question, what will the Cubs do with Darvish coming back? Because Darvish has an ERA near 5, which is a far cry from how Montgomery has been doing. Some people have suggested that the Cubs will shift to a 6-man rotation. That way Darvish could have extra days of rest in between his starts, so that way he won't necessarily have to go back on the DL again for fatigue-related injuries. But yet, is that an ideal option? Because nobody in baseball necessarily uses a 6-man rotation. The Angels tried it at the start of the year, but with Shohei Ohtani's injury, they've been forced to cut it back to 5 as well. So, It's very difficult to predict how the Cubs are going to respond to this situation. One thing I will say, though, don't demote Mike Montgomery. If he's doing well, don't punish him by moving him back to the bullpen. That's one thing that the Cubs need to keep in mind. Montgomery's done great and has been the glue to hold this starting rotation together during these injuries and problems. Why demote him and why punish him like that? The Cubs need to find a way to accommodate to Montgomery and keep him in the starting rotation, even when Darvish makes a return. Also, in other Cubs news, the All-Star Game, both totals have been updated, and Wilson Contreras is in second place behind Buster Posey. So the question is, who really deserves to start in the All-Star Game at the catcher's position? Now, many will argue Posey because he's so accomplished as a player. He's a Rookie of the Year, MVP, multiple World Series rings, but this year, not having the best of seasons. Sure, he's hitting .290, but his OPS is under .800 because his slugging percentage is only at .420. Looking at Wilson Contreras, who has an OPS of .803, I think Contreras deserves to start. Maybe the batting average for Contreras at .278 is not as good as one would like, but having a high on base at .370 and a slugging over .430, you're going to tell me he doesn't deserve it? Offensively, he deserves it. Sabermetrically, he deserves it. He has a WAR of 2.2 compared to Posey's 1.9. Candidly speaking, with the exception of Javier Baez competing at second base, there aren't any other Cubs who really deserve an All-Star Game selection. Anthony Rizzo's been having a horrible season, and Chris Bryant is suffering from a power outage at the plate. You're going to tell me that those two guys deserve to make it over guys like Eugenio Suarez at third base and Brandon Belt at first base? I don't think so. Right now, the Cubs should be focusing on Wilson Contreras and Javier Baez making an All-Star Game. Rizzo and Bryant, I'm sorry, but they don't deserve to be in the game this year. Moving to the south side, and it's now time to talk about some Chicago White Sox news. Big news for the White Sox, folks. Jose Abreu leads all American League first basemen in the AL All-Star Game vote, and he's well deserving of that honor. We had talked about it a few weeks ago on another podcast of ours that Jose Abreu, statistically speaking, is the best first baseman in baseball, but because he's on one of the worst teams in the game, nobody is seeming to take notice. In the latest AL voting update released today, Jose Abreu has a commanding lead over Mitch Moreland, who's in second place, a lead of over 160,000 votes. And it makes sense because, looking at his statistics, Abreu, who's hitting .283 with an .838 OPS and 11 home runs, is surely more deserving of that starting spot than Mitch Moreland or Yuli Gurriel sitting in third. Moreland this season, although he does have a higher OPS at .882, is hitting only .276 with 10 home runs in 56 games. Moreland is almost like a part-time player. Abreu's played in 69 games this year and almost has 300 plate appearances. Moreland just passed 200 on his personal mark. And Yuli Gurriel has 245 plate appearances and is hitting .305 but has only 2 home runs all season long. He's experiencing a power outage, as last season he had 18 homers and 75 RBIs. And the funny part about all this is we all know why Moreland and Gurriel are receiving high vote totals. Well, one plays for the Red Sox, who are currently in first place in the AL East, and the other plays for the Astros, one of the hottest teams in baseball, the reigning World Series champion as well. So of course, their cities are going to rally behind them as they take not only the regional stage, but the national stage. Everybody knows who Yuli Gurriel and Mitch Moreland are at this point, but few know who Jose Abreu is. And to make matters better for Abreu, Miguel Cabrera, who was doing very well in the voting and had risen to the third spot, has now been diagnosed with an injury that will keep him out for the rest of the year. Cabrera wasn't necessarily having the best year of his career, but was hitting .299 with an on-base percentage near .400. He wasn't doing horrible, but now that he's out of the picture, there's another perennial superstar who won't be in the way of Abreu starting this All-Star game. And here's a valid question that I'd like to receive some answers to. In 2014, Abreu's rookie year, he was an All-Star. He was named Rookie of the Year and finished fourth in the MVP voting. But ever since then, he has never been to an All-Star game. And I don't understand why. I mean, he hit 290, 293, and then 304 these past 3 years. Each year he's gotten at least 25 homers and 100 RBIs. It makes no sense to me why he's gotten no recognition. Finally, this year, in a year which may not be his best but is still very good in comparison to the other first baseman out there, he deserves to be in the All-Star game. There are no questions to pose, and there's no doubt about it in my mind. Congrats to Jose Abreu, keep up the good work, and Sox fans, keep voting, as Abreu deserves to be starting in the All-Star game this year. From the baseball diamond to the gridiron, we now talk about some Chicago Bears news. With OTAs and rookie minicamp over, the Bears have some off time right now until training camp down in Bourbonnais near the end of July. Despite this off period, the Bears have made some news that will delight all Bears fans, including ones who were fans from 2005 through 2009. The Bears unveiled their orange Nike jerseys that they will wear this season in games at Miami on October 14th and at home against the Vikings on November 18th. They last wore the orange jerseys in 2011 after also using them from 2005 to 2009. My goodness, I'm so happy the Bears have made the decision to bring back these orange jerseys. These jerseys remind all Chicago Bears fans of the nostalgia that surrounded that 2005 and 2006 Chicago Bears team, the one that made it to the Super Bowl, the one that housed the Monsters of the Midway, and the one that had Devin Hester as a rookie, returning punts and kickoff returns. Simply put, the orange jerseys have a special part in Bears history. And what makes it so interesting is that this new generation of Bears players, having Mitchell Trubisky, drafting new players and being ready for a winning season, this will allow them to come full circle. They'll have the nostalgia that surrounds the last very good Bears team, along with the new guys who try to make it and live up to that legacy. It's an exciting time to be a Bears fan once again, and with these new jerseys coming back to life, the Bears will finally recapture their glory days of old while blending them with their glory days yet to come. In other Bears news, Roquan Smith was named a winner at Chicago Bears OTA minicamp by Patrick Hurley, a writer who covers the Bears and who was at OTA minicamp. Listen to what he had to say about Roquan Smith and his role on the Bears defense. As an extension of Danny Trevathan, Roquan Smith has been a winner this offseason. He has followed Trevathan around the field and mimicked his practice movements. Smith is looking to become a seasoned vet and is watching the veteran learn to grow. Trevathan has been happy to assist, and the two should be growing excellent chemistry together. This should translate to great chemistry in terms of communication on Sundays. The Chicago Bears have already flirted with the idea of Smith calling plays. Trevathan already has no problems with handing off that baton. So even though I was a bit skeptical about Roquan Smith, especially with the fact that he was literally a copy of Leonard Floyd, a linebacker from Georgia with a very good senior season, it's nice to hear that he's doing something reassuring at camp. I mean, having a rookie call plays, he must have some very good football IQ, and this is just the beginning for him. So a lot of good words and good potential coming out of Bears OTA minicamp about Roquan Smith. And before we get to our special guest, let's talk about some Chicago Blackhawks news. The Hawks are in the news right now for a big reason. The NHL draft is coming up, and some are saying that the Hawks might consider trading their number 8 overall pick. Although these rumors have been floating around on the internet for a couple of weeks, according to a report by Scott Powers of The Athletic Chicago, the Hawks are unlikely to trade their number 8 overall pick in this year's draft, but have discussed trading the number 27 pick. Here's a quote from the article. Chicago has a top 10 pick for the first time since 2007, when they drafted Patrick Kane with the top overall pick. According to the Hawks, there's plenty of talented players the Hawks are excited about, and the Hawks could use the number 27 pick as a way to upgrade their center position. Here's my take on the topic. The Hawks have been fortunate enough to receive a first-round pick, one in the top 10, for the first time since drafting Patrick Kane. That itself is a godsend, something the Hawks have not done because they've been winning so much. But with a bad year last season, I feel like they need to take advantage and use this pick to improve the team. Why should you trade it away and waste the opportunity to draft the next Patrick Kane or Jonathan Taves? That makes no sense. Therefore, for the Hawks in this situation, need to exercise common sense. If they have the number 8 overall pick, they have guys they're interested in getting, why even think about trading it away? Grab someone who you know can be the franchise player and help carry the load with Patrick Kane and Jonathan Taves. Let's be honest, those two guys won't be here forever. You're drafting someone right now who has the possibility to succeed both Kane and Taves and be the next generation, the next franchise player for the Hawks. So at this point, don't trade away that pick and draft someone that you know will make a difference in the future. And with that, it's now time for our special guest. He began his career in sports media with the St. Louis Cardinals, serving as a radio producer for the team's flagship station. He then became the sports director at WTHI-TV. By 2003, he was a part of CBS Sports Network, where he served as the primary host of their college sports coverage. Today, he is the host of MLB Tonight, exclusively on MLB Network. Please welcome Greg Amsinger to the show. Greg, how are you doing today? And thank you for being here on the show.
Oh, John, I'm telling you what, that was a tremendous introduction. I forgot some parts of my career. You just reminded me. Thank you.
No problem at all. As I said, thank you for being here. So first off, Greg, I'd like to take a look at some interesting MLB headlines, starting with Shohei Ohtani, one of my personal favorite stories. I mean, this guy's hitting and pitching at a high level. These are things we really haven't seen since, you know, the days of Babe Ruth. What are your thoughts on Ohtani's impact on the game, and do you see him making a quick return to the field after this injury?
I hope that Shohei Ohtani can get back hitting at least. I don't know if we're going to see him pitch again. I'm worried that he may eventually have to have Tommy John surgery. Now, we've seen guys avoid it, Tanaka being one of them, Garrett Richards, his teammate with the Angels, being another. But this is a guy that they have a long-term investment in, and they really believe that Ohtani is going to be the ace for a while. His bat is important to this team. It's trying to get into the wild card mix. He's a great hitter. That's what we've learned. And they don't want to lose that aspect of his talents. To me, what it's reminding Major League Baseball teams that are interested in this two-way star is if there is an injury, you're losing two players. You're not just losing a pitcher. So you're rolling the dice when you try to implement someone with this kind of unique skill set. I don't know if he's helped the cause of the two-way player, but he's definitely not hurt it because he's been a very impressive pitcher and a very impressive hitter.
You know, you mentioned Masahiro Tanaka avoiding the Tommy John surgery. Some may argue, though, that because he avoided it, he really hasn't been the same pitcher. Could you see that possibly happening with Ohtani and this UCL injury as well?
Well, he's also getting older, and there are a lot of miles on that right arm. As a pitcher that has a split that he is, I don't know if he needs the incredible velocity that other pitchers require. I think Masahiro Tanaka hasn't, I don't think he's been a liability to this rotation in any sense. I really don't think that. He wasn't what he was when he broke in, which was the most dominant pitching sensation we had seen since Hideo Nomo when he broke in with the Dodgers and won Rookie of the Year in the National League. I don't know if we're ever going to see that guy again, but he is someone that can come and give you quality starts, pitch in the postseason. I just think he set the bar so high when he broke in. We're not, that guy's gone. The new ace of the Yankees going forward is clearly Luis Severino.
You know, being a Chicago sports website, I did want to touch on the Cubs, who sit just a half a game behind the Brewers in the NL Central Division race. What needs to go right for the team to overcome Milwaukee and then make a good run in the postseason?
Their strength against the Brewers is their starting pitching. The bullpen, while Brandon Morrow has been so good in the ninth inning, can't compete with what the Brewers have. They've got the new version of the Nasty Boys, John. Jeremy Jeffress to Hader, to Corey Knebel. I mean, those three guys have made it a five-inning game because Josh Hader can come and pitch and get more than 3 outs. So advantage Brewers when it comes to bullpen. But when it comes to starting pitching, the John Lesters, the Hendricks, the Quintanas, and yes, the Darvishes, they have to out outperform the starting pitching for the Brewers, which shouldn't be that tall order of a task. I think the Cubs eventually are going to win this division. The bats are coming alive. Even Jason Hayward's flirting with a .270 batting average. It's just weird that Chris Bryant would go a month without a home run. We know reality is going to set in there. Rizzo's going to start turning it back up. I don't think he hits .246 for the rest of the year. Kyle Schwarber's showing incredible power. Addison Russell's coming alive lately. The Cubs are coming out of hibernation, I guess you could say, offensively. And the starting pitching, which was going to, I think, put them over the top in the NL Central, a reason why they won the World Series in 2016, I think it's going to be the strength again in the second half of the year, and that's why the Cubs are going to run away with the division.
And on the south side of town, we know that the White Sox are in the middle of a rebuild, which certainly explains their 24-46 record. But, you know, rebuilds have generally gone well. I mean, look at the Cubs, look at the Astros. The past two World Series winners had rebuilds back in the early 2010s. Do you see the White Sox achieving this same type of success in the future?
They're a sleeping giant. I look at the White Sox as the American League version of the San Diego Padres. Why do I do that? Look at the farm systems. The farm systems are loaded with talent. Now, some of the prospects the White Sox went out and got, John, have not performed at a high level. Lucas Giolito, I think, has been very disappointing. But they're not going to punt on Lucas Giolito. They've got him penciled in their rotation for the long haul. You know, the Kopech and the Ronaldo Lopez's, you can dream on these guys. Lopez is doing it in the big leagues right now, and I think he's pretty good. Look, we forget Carlos Rondon was still a can't-miss guy. When he gets healthy, he's back. This is a team that's got a core based around pitching, and that's always going to lead you to the promised land. Yoan Moncada has to be their best player. He's the most talented player that they have. Yes, even more than Jose Abreu. He's the most talented player on the team. He's going to have to be their version of Mike Trout. No one can be Mike Trout. I understand that. But he has to be the face of the franchise for the White Sox if this rebuild is going to turn around. I'll give you a better comp. You brought up the Astros. That was a rebuild. Moncada has to be their Altuve. And he's that good, he could do that.
Well, now I wanted to move to your personal career in broadcast journalism, and I'd love to hear your story of how you became such a recognizable figure in sports media today. How did it start, and how did you end up being the top host at MLB Network?
Well, I really lucked out. I've been blessed with so many great people along the way in my career, John. The most influential in my career is a guy named Tony Petitti. He's the right-hand man to the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred, way back when. After I left Terre Haute, Indiana and local TV, I got a break to be the main studio host of College Sports Television, which was eventually purchased by CBS Sports, which was run by an executive producer named Tony Petitti. He renamed it CBS Sports Network, and that channel still exists today. Tony watched me do live look-ins of NCAA tournament games on the CBS Sports Network. And he saw that I liked to ad-lib and almost do play-by-play from a studio of a bunch of different games at once with different analysts along the way. And I was a bit of a marathon broadcaster. I really like being on television for hours on end. I'm crazy that way. So when he started this network, he was plucked away from CBS Sports to be the CEO of MLB Network. And the network was going to launch January 1st, 2009. It just happened that my contract was running out at that time. And he knew that, and he specifically came for me, knowing that I was from St. Louis. I was a huge Cardinal fan growing up, loved baseball, and I liked ad-lib, non-scripted television. So he knew what he was doing in terms of how the programming of this network was going to be, so much live studio television, and how MLB Tonight was going to be constructed, which is live look-ins of all the games going on that night. So it really was the perfect fit. I have my dream job, and it's not that I was angling for this kind of success. I expected to be in local TV for the rest of my life, and I was going to be totally thrilled with that. I was going to be so happy if I was a local sports guy in St. Louis. I did not expect anything more than that. But Tony Petitti really did change my career and then my life as well, because he believed in me, and things have worked out well.
And what's interesting, too, like you mentioned, is that you've been with the network since its creation back in 2009. What was it like during the first days of the network, and how were you guys able to make it grow into what it is today?
Well, what Tony did is he hired an executive producer named John Entz, who now is a major executive for Fox Sports. Before he came to MLB Network, he oversaw the Best Damn Sports Show, which had a lot of success and a good run for a while on Fox Sports. He came over, and those two guys together really did an amazing job of not only hiring talented former players and hosts and reporters, but good people, great people. And the other thing that they did, which I was, and this is going to sound like it doesn't make any sense because you're talking to a studio host right now, but what they decided to do was they made the network's biggest stars the former players. And that is completely different than almost any other channel. I mean, ESPN, the biggest stars are Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann back in the day. It was always the SportsCenter anchors. The analysts weren't the pillars of the network, right? So what he did is he wanted Harold Reynolds to be the face of the network, and Harold has been the face of the network since 2009. And he hired a guy that no one really thought of to be a TV star, like Dan Plesac, who's become one of the signature faces and voices of this network. He's hired hilarious personalities like Kevin Millar and Sean Casey, stoic personalities like Mike Lowell and Pedro Martinez, and all of these, the mixture that we have, John Smoltz. We all are friends. We all hang out. We all play golf together. It is such a wonderful family environment because not only do they hire people with great backgrounds in the sport or broadcasting, but good people. It is a wonderful experience to walk in the doors here at MLB Network. It really is.
And you mentioned that because on TV, we see lots of funny moments, and obviously you guys have a lot of chemistry together. What makes it fun to work at MLB Network?
I think when you're on live TV so long, all of your imperfections will be exposed. And if you don't laugh at those, you're going to cry at those. So my weakness on live TV, I have no reference for pop culture. John, I don't watch TV. I don't watch movies. I don't listen to music. I'm outside playing with my kids, playing golf. I'm always doing something. So I don't sit down and watch television. I have no idea what's going on in the world. And that eventually comes up when you're on live TV for 3 hours a night. Somehow, some way, that your weakness will be exposed. If your weakness is you don't know all the relievers in the Seattle Mariners bullpen, believe it or not, at some point, that weakness will be exposed. So the format lends itself to humility. You cannot be overproduced working on MLB Tonight. It's not a 30-minute pregame and postgame show where it's overproduced and, you know, you practice what you're going to say and there's rehearsals. And no, we just fly by the seat of our pants. It is an organized train wreck. That's how I explain MLB Tonight. It's the hardest show to produce. It really is hard. And our production staff is amazing. We have people behind the scenes that are truly stars in the industry. We've had a lot of success on MLB Tonight, and I don't want to stop doing it.
And I asked that question because I know there are many funny moments that you have been a part of, including one where you were standing in Studio 42 for an update, and behind you, Harold Reynolds was taking some BP. And all of a sudden, you were beamed in the back with a ball. Do you forgive Harold for what happened?
Well, it's a funny moment because the guys in Studio 3 were talking to us in Studio 42. That's our little miniature baseball stadium and field. And I'm standing right in front of the camera, and I see a wiffle ball. They're interacting with me. I see a wiffle ball fly past my ear. And they're like, oh, watch out. Now I'm standing right around the mound, okay, and the camera's facing me. And Bill Ripken is flipping wiffle balls to Harold, and Harold's trying to hit me. But, you know, as great as these guys are, it's live television, and the chances that he's going to drill me, I thought were slim to none. I really didn't think I was going to get hit. I thought maybe, you know, I didn't think he was that good. And he drilled me in the backside, and wiffle balls are not supposed to feel like that, John. They're not supposed to feel like that. And the pain that I experienced, it's my fault for doubting the talent of a former All-Star. Harold proved his point.
And on a final note, I wanted to ask, is it true that you sleep in a suit? Because I remember MLB Network doing a video of you actually sleeping in your work clothes and waking up and going straight to the set for MLB Tonight. So, is it true?
No, it's not true. But I am crazy about that. And I'm a creature of habit, very much like a left-handed starting pitcher. I am lefty. I'm a weird lefty. And I like showing up to work in a suit. And I just believe, like, live television, when you work in TV, you have no idea what's going to happen. There could be breaking news. And even in baseball, I mean, I remember Alex Rodriguez and the big steroid story that came out, and all of a sudden, boom, we're running onto the set. Well, who do they get from the air? Not the guy that's sitting in a T-shirt and shorts. You know, not that host. If I'm sitting there in a suit and I'm ready to go, Amsterdam, you go do it. And I love hosting live TV. I just love it. So I've always been ready to go. I walk in a suit. I'm in the meeting all day in my suit. And the other part of it, and I have to be completely honest, very candid here, I'm also very lazy. I don't understand the double laundry thing, John. Like, why pick out an outfit to go to work and then you have to fold that, put it in a duffel bag, take it back or change back? I don't. Changing clothes is so annoying. So it's a simpler way of life for me to just show up in a suit.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for being here on the show. It was quite a memorable interview, and feel free to come on again in the future. I had a great time with you today.
Oh, great questions, John. It was a fun interview. Thanks so much.
What an honor it was to have Greg Amsinger on today's show. We talked about some Cubs and Sox news, his personal career in sports media, and some MLB headlines. A special thank you to Greg for coming on today's show. And right now, it's time for our final closing segment, the announcer's call of the day. Here's the situation. The White Sox are taking on the Orioles at Camden Yards in Baltimore. It's 4-3 White Sox. Chris Davis of the Orioles is at the plate with two on and one out. What would happen next would be incredible. Let's listen to the legendary Gary Thorne on the call.
Chris has hit into only two double plays this year. 3-2 delivery and a fly ball right field. It is way back. Chris Davis, the fly, home run. Orioles win. Bottom of the ninth.
What a call there by the legendary Gary Thorne, and what a clutch home run hit by Chris Davis. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Also, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can find the subscription area on the homepage of the site. Simply type in your email, then confirm in your inbox, and you will be able to receive the latest podcasts and articles that appear on our site directly to your email. Thank you again for listening to today's show, and have a great day.